You're listening to Expansion on RepublicBroadcasting.org, the RBN Network. This is Sophia, your host, and my guest today is Jennifer Lake, with whom we're catching up after her trip abroad and her extended research. And she has just explained to us that the spraying of aerosols in the atmosphere is simply another form of inoculation. I didn't realize that that was the real meaning of inoculation. I thought it had to do with needles. It was like injection. But I guess, as you say, it's anything that's ingested.
Right. It's something that, you know, when you, in the process of making a cheese, if you take a culture and you put it in your cheese, it inoculates your cheese. People who make compost, they often use the bacteria that have grown in a previous compost, and they put it in a new one if they make it, and they inoculate that compost so that they produce a continuum for the bacteria or the fungi, whatever it is, to grow on its own and have that new resource available to grow in. So an inoculation is just injecting a template of a life form into a new medium so that it can culture itself. So when we breathe, when we eat, you know, these things are also inoculations, and we're doing it all the time. We just think that we're having this exchange with our environment, and we are. This is how we do it. So when I was in Europe, Sophia, I think what really came into perspective for me was getting a grip on the dark side of things. I spent about a week in Paris, and I was at Notre Dame, and I saw an image there that I had never seen looking at photos of Notre Dame. They have a large door niche right in the center. They have three of them across the front. But the one in the middle is called the Portal of the Last Judgment. And when you look up at these carvings, there are demons all over it. And up above, about 20 feet over your head, is life-size image of the figure of justice holding a scale. And she's holding the world on her scale. And cozied up right next to her is the image of the devil. And he's got his hand over her scale. And what really struck me about the carvings on the cathedral, all the popes and all the kings and other images, they look straight out at the horizon. But the faces of the devil and the demons that are on this building look down at the people. They look right at you. They're grinning and glaring at you. And I was really sort of taken by that, because Americans don't see that kind of design work around us in our buildings, but they certainly do in Paris. I'm sure they do in other places as well. And so I realized that, well, this has been a very long-standing kind of a thought form that's out into the world.
You're talking about the middle door?
The middle door.
The big entry door. I'm looking at a picture of it now.
Yeah.
It's right under the rose window. And I can't see too well in this particular photo, but you're saying that there are demons and gargoyles and things like that looking down at the people.
Right. Well, the cathedral is famous for its gargoyles, and you can find lots of pictures where they show that close up. But I had never before seen an image of this devil with his hand manipulating the world scale. I had never seen that image in a photograph about Notre Dame before, but I got to stand in front of the building and see it then. So that, like so many things, you know, it just, there's this understory, and I caught up on some of the reading, things that I had heard about, things that I was really not prepared to handle. I read the Franklin cover-up, a book that you're familiar with, and began to really tie into my context this Luciferian element that has been out there.
Well, we have our break music, and we will be back in a few minutes with Jennifer Lake. You're listening to Expansion on RepublicBroadcasting.org, the RBN Network. This is Sophia, your host, and I'm speaking today with Jennifer Lake, doing a catch-up on her research and discoveries over the summer. Now, you had brought up that there was Luciferian content to the, I guess you could call it artwork, architecture, images. Well, you know, it's not like we don't have any of this. We do have universities. I was taken on a tour of University of Texas in Austin, and they have plenty of gargoyles there. Thank you very much.
They do, huh?
Yeah. I mean, some of these buildings, I don't know exactly when they date from, but those elements were included here, and I know they're very prevalent in Europe. I'm looking at the Notre Dame gargoyles. They're horrible. These are on the, I guess they're above one of the doors, but they're not showing the image that you talked about. But at any rate, I would like you to discuss more about this whole Luciferian theme.
You know, I really wanted to be sure, you know, so I just kept my eyes peeled while I was traveling around. One of the things that I did was I toured the castles that are on the Loire Valley, you know, the beautiful, amazing medieval castles. And what I saw there just kind of did it. That put me over the top. I went into these huge halls and things and looked along the ceilings, and they have giant beams, and these little niches in every corner had little grotesque carvings in them. And what they had there were very bizarre-looking faces that were in the process of mangling human beings, babies and women for the most part. And these odd faces would have parts of limbs and bloody, dripping bodies hanging out of their mouths. This was just a different kind of level of gargoyle to me. And I saw enough of that and began to see really this whole story coming through and looking carefully at tapestries and things. You know, what was happening there to me and what these people were practicing was a different kind of religion. It's not the religion that we know, but it certainly has become an element in the large religion today. And a lot of people have called it the Mystery Babylon religion. And that kind of condenses into what we know as Judaic Talmudism. So the Talmud has been the support for this kind of Luciferianism. And it really fits with the history, too, with the rise of the Zionist political movement, that Zionism really carried this on into the world. So,
explain about how it's the Talmudic connection again. I don't quite understand that.
The Talmud is the law, more or less, but the doctrine, the dogma of its much older source material, which is the Babylonian mystery religion. And you know, there are other people who speak really well to this. In fact, just a couple days ago, I listened to one of Jim Condit's shows, and I know you had Jim Condit on your show.
Mm-hmm.
He did a series of interviews he called Wag the Dog, and he had Michael Hoffman on his show, who just wrote a new book. He's got a book that's called Judaism Discovered, and he's a master of his subject. He just, you know, laid out in a very short time sort of the basis of this religious belief. And this was about actually besting God, as he said it, that the legal structure of the Talmudic religion had challenged God and won, that they had actually, you know, devised circumnavigations of logic in such a way that they were able to even puzzle and best the God overall. So this is a tradition that, you know, just kind of winds its way through all of this and through what I realized and have known for a long time was a satanic support system that Judaism and therefore its offspring, which are Christianity and Islam, have been a support network for satanic religion. And that just became very clear to me. And when I bring it up to date, and listen to other people who've been trying to pass this message on and get us to realize that this Luciferianism that exists is what this globalization is all about, that this is the leadership. This identifies them as using the symbols, the means, and the science.
Well, just to play devil's advocate, would it not make sense that when they are building a cathedral, that, you know, let's go back in time. How can I even think like people then? But I'll try. Would they not want to include images of good and evil, since religion is really all about making choices between good and evil? So the Luciferian creatures that they, you know, stick on the doors and above people, would these not just represent, hey, folks, you have two choices. You can do this or you can do that. You can be good or you can be bad. Is that too simplistic?
Well, it's just one branch. You know, I mean, there are certainly other kinds of wisdom traditions and teachings that don't put it in those terms,
mm-hmm.
and never have. And when I think about, you know, what I've learned as an American about Native American traditions, it's just never put into those terms, that when you make choices, there are wise choices and not wise choices. And they're just not given this kind of absolutism and this great duality and what this...
And they're not characterized by devils and demons.
Right.
Yeah, I guess it's the characterization that comes across. The imagery represents that characterization. It makes almost... It personifies the two kinds of choice that we can make,
yeah.
I suppose. But I don't know. It seems to me that there is something collective about these specters, these demonic specters. People seem to have them in their dreams all over the world, and I don't know exactly where they come from. But I would assume that people not exposed to French early Christian artwork in France would not be able to say, well, that's where I saw demons first, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But,
well, you know, don't you think that that's a metaphysical reality? If we take the instructions that thought creates form, as we have these thoughts, then they do become manifest. So to dream of devils, to see devils, to have this experience, you know, it's just a fulfillment of something that we accept as a basis of our creativity, which is that we think it, and then we create it.
Well, there's also the idea of programming. You know, I don't think that the early builders and social organizers were beyond programming. And that programming goes very, very far back. And I just was given a preview copy of a film, Programming the Nation.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know when it'll be released, if it'll be a large theatrical release, but it was all about subliminal messaging, which isn't, I mean, what you're describing, gargoyles carved into churches, is not subliminal, but it's a form of programming also.
Mm-hmm.
It's cultural.
Well, yeah, so our programming now is just very sophisticated. We're kind of looking at that and making light of it and laughing at it, or perhaps not. But, you know, it doesn't seem to be moving people very much these days to be confronted by that imagery. But as far as the symbols go, the symbols have persisted through time, and so much of our consciousness then is defined in terms of symbols. So we are still there. We're still dealing with these old symbols. And if there are within, you know, the structure of our elite and our politicians and our industrial champions and everything else, if they are practicing these Luciferian religion rituals, then we have something to be very concerned about. And that's what the Franklin cover-up talks about, you know, in a most distressing kind of a way. And that really sort of tore away, though, the last of the veils for me, in a sense, that if this is really happening in our world today, then we have no choice but to make these connections and say, look, this is really what's going on. This is what we face. This is much more than arguing about whether a virus is organic or inorganic. This is really important. We've been pushed to this place. We've been led symbolically to this place that when things divided, when the theories of pleomorphism as the true natural way that organisms arrived was divided and separated, and germ theory was taken up as the real method of controlling the populace, and that this would be the foundation of public medicine. Well, this secret strain of research keeps going on along this more appropriate and real line of.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Listening to Expansion at republicbroadcasting.org, the RBN network. I am your host, Sophia, and my guest today is Jennifer Lake, and we have been talking about the diabolical disease model. I guess that's where we have to take it. People use the word diabolical with reference to Morgellons and chemtrails, and we can take it further back and take it to the, you know, early 1900s and say the Rockefellers and the Flexners, they were doing the same thing.
This is when it becomes meaningful to us, what happened then. And, you know, tracking polio has been an amazingly interesting experience for me because I take it back right to the time period and find that it made a perfect bioweapon. It was really just the ticket. Even though they couldn't see it, they knew how to procure it. They knew how to get it. And how you create a virus, if that's the really the exact mechanism that was going on, you would take serum from victims and you would strain it. You would run it through an ultra-high filter. It gets pulled through a porcelain filter. And anything that's too large stays behind. So bacteria and organisms that had already formed themselves into grosser entities would not be included. And they would pull the serum through, and just the smallest particulate matter would come through there. But they would also be breaking this stuff apart as they did this, and really reducing something to its, you know, most basic kind of form. So small particles in fluid. And then they would go from there by attempting to culture it and grow it and see what would grow. And, you know, and from the very beginning, I wanted to go and ask questions. Well, does it mean it was there already, or was it something that developed as they were?
When you say it, does it mean it was there already? What are you talking about?
It meaning virus.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning the organism itself. Was there a tiny, tiny organism there?
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know my theory on that. I don't think that viruses are organisms. They are not. They are chemicals. But were they there as compounds? Did they exist in the form in which we recognize them as virus? And that doesn't have to be true. They could have really just been separated chemicals that were sitting already in the matrix in which they would grow, and so they became sort of a development after the fact, because viruses take on crystalline structures. They, you know, become compounds of whatever it is that's there in this mix, just like a primordial soup. It's how they form themselves. And we know we can grow crystals in labs. And we know from geologists like Robert Folkes that nanobes are growing things. They reproduce. The whole theory about life from clay is that these things, whatever they are, they grow and they reproduce. It's fascinating. So this is the basis of nanotechnology. And years ago, I read Terence McKenna and remember feeling very blown away by him. He was a botanist. That was his specialty, and he went to tribal societies around the world, and he studied shamanism, and he studied hallucinogenics, and he, I think, really became the science fiction next wave for us. He showed us a lot about the potential of where this kind of technology would go, and he talked about how the technology then would interface with us, and that we would partially become this engineered kind of organism ourselves. So I think we're very much there. There's a project that DARPA is working on. It's called Gollum, just like the creature in The Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
And the Gollum,
how do you spell it?
You spell it G-O-L-E-M.
That's not Gollum from The Lord of the Rings.
It's
That's
not
the Golem.
The Golem.
That's life from clay.
Okay.
That's the legend. It's a Talmudic legend.
There you go.
From Prague. Actually, I shouldn't say it originated in Prague. I don't know where it originated. But if you Google the Golem, G-O-L-E-M, Golem is G-O-L-L-U-M.
Ah, well, there you go.
Far newer. The Golem is an ancient, ancient legend about a huge Frankensteinian-type monster,
mm-hmm.
a figure, rather, who lies sleeping in an attic in Prague. I remember reading about this when I was 10 in a Marvel comic, and it just electrified me. It was so spooky and mythic. The Golem sleeps, and he can come to life if you inscribe on his forehead the Hebrew word for life. And then he awakens and he does your bidding. He does whatever needs to. He's much like the monster in Frankenstein. And I think the ultimate legend ultimately says that he worked against his controllers. He kind of got out of control. So I don't know exactly. I can't remember from when I was 10 how it ended. But that is the goal. So we'll carry on with this thread after our break.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Expansion on republicbroadcasting.org, the RBN Network. This is Sophia, your host, and my guest is Jennifer Lake. And we were just getting into a discussion about, was it some form of research or what you're calling the Golem?
There's a project being done by DARPA called the Golem Project.
Okay, well, I Wikipedia'd it, and it's in the shortest form, and they do describe several different Jewish legends,
right?
Called Golem. But anyway, to deactivate the Golem, the rabbi rubbed out the first letter of the word emet, truth or reality, from the creature's forehead, leaving the Hebrew word met, M-E-T, meaning death. So I had it wrong from my memory as a child. It wasn't the word
death.
Yes, so truth, emet, E-M-E-T is truth or reality. That's what it means. And if you take the E away, then M-E-T is apparently death.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what significance that has for the DARPA project.
They've just named the project that this is an artificial intelligence bio-interface project. And you know, any manner of speculation would do. I don't have any inside track on this technology or what they're actually working on. But when you say that, the term of artificial intelligence, biological interface, then I'm thinking that this is cyborg technology. This is a way to just redesign biology and to have a creator's control into this process by introducing perhaps nanomachines. This is Terence McKenna's vision coming true. Tolkien may have been actually thinly disguising the golem in his character, in his character of Gollum. What happens to this character at the end of this story is that he goes into the lake of fire inside Mount Doom because he's irredeemably a slave of his master.
Well, here it says, the existence of a golem is sometimes a mixed blessing. I'm reading from Wikipedia, which we know is edited by every Tom, Dick, and Harry. But anyway, this seems pretty, straightforward. Golems are not intelligent. If commanded to perform a task, they will take the instructions perfectly literally. Then I go down. In its earliest known modern form, the story has Rabbi Eliyahu of Kelm, C-H-E-L-M, I don't know how to say it, creating a golem that became enormous and uncooperative. In one version of this, the rabbi had to resort to trickery to deactivate it, whereupon it crumbled upon its creator and crushed him.
Mm-hmm. Well, supposedly Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, this was based on the legend of the golem.
Yes.
Literary people were very well aware of this. Stories have been written about it. Isaac Bashevis, the singer who wrote the story Yentl that Barbara Streisand made a movie from, he wrote quite a bit about Golem. He took up this subject matter in his writings. So it's like a creepy legend. It's out there. It's a part of our ideology. And this seems to be, in one sense, the actual desire of military and government is to bring this controllable element into physical experience. So what I think about is I think that avian influenza, which is given the initials of AI, which is the same initials as artificial intelligence.
Oh, avian flu?
Right.
I see.
If we just think of it at that most basic level as being AI, that we know that we can have artificial life injected into us by way of a vaccine. Now, if a flu vaccine went around the world as something that they didn't have back when the Spanish flu hit the world and 100 million or more people died, if they were able to have a situation where this kind of a pandemic would sweep the globe, then they could take a vaccine and administer it completely to all countries and deliver to us anything they would like in the name of the avian flu. So they can do this with virus. This is how genetic therapy works. They use virus to deliver genetic packages, because this is what viruses do. Besides behave as solvents and break down aberrant cell material and help you eliminate it. We talked about this the very first time I was on with you.
Mm-hmm.
But now they use virus, and they like using the polio virus because it's very small, that it's very effective at moving through the blood-brain barrier and into all kinds of neurological structures, and it can really literally go any place in the body. So it's
like a taxi.
It's a taxi, exactly, for anything they want. Now, there's a book out called The Polio Paradox, and this was written as a manual to help people who've had polio or who have some kind of a related neurological illness. And he does explain very simply and clearly that when he published this book, and I think that was in 2002.
And who's the author?
The author is a doctor named Richard Bruno.
Mm-hmm.
And he was bringing people up to date on where polio technology was at this point. And, you know, this has been a model organism. Okay, again, I use that really loosely when I say organism, but they've been using the polio virus in their genetic package delivery experiments because it's so effective. It was highly infectious during the 50s when we had all this fallout. It's a mutated virus to begin with, and it responds very well when people have damage in their tissues. The polio virus can just go anywhere. So they're using it for therapy purposes, they say.
Mm-hmm.
But they hollow it out. Those are his words. They hollow it out, and then they can put inside that hollow anything that the scientist desires. So they can.
So it's a very cooperative instrument.
Right.
It's not only a taxi, but it really goes wherever you tell it to go.
Yes.
For free.
Mm-hmm. So with at least even just in the case of this one disease, it really covers the spectrum. That virus will be the way to program us. It works very, very well. They've known how to do it for a long time. And this idea that there's all kinds of biological agents in the chemtrails could very well be this thing. It could be these re-engineered poliovirus because they're so handy at inoculating us just by means of ingestion.
Just by means of our
right
digestion, did you say?
By ingestion.
Ingestion.
Right. Whether we swallow them on food or whether they're actually even being produced by food, that's a possibility. So they could be coming in the form of chemtrails. You know, we're dealing with this mindset that was able to create an arms race based on mutually assured destruction that had 100 times more killing power than it ever needed. So,
and which arms race are you talking about?
I'm talking about the nuclear arms race.
Yes.
Yes, and the spread of nuclear weapons all around the globe. The intensity of each nuclear weapon, the fact that, you know, if you had 10 kilotons, you could take that device and you could make it deliver 100 megatons. So, you know, it's just to increase the killing power of things. So if we think that there is a kind of a Luciferian genocidal agenda at work here, you know, they've got the perfect thing that they need in the form of virus. And in the understanding that they've very well developed this other thread of science that has not been the basis of our medicine, which is this polymorphism, transitional forms, the fact that life forms arise from chemistry.
Well, it almost seems like the nuclear arms race and the theater and drama created around that is just to distract us from the other stuff that they've been doing, you know? While we argue about who should have nuclear weapons and who shouldn't, and the danger of detonating them, here we are being infused with killer agents every second of the day. I'm amazed we're walking around. I say that all the time.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's just a testament to our place, I think, because we belong. We belong.
We belong where?
We belong wherever we are. We belong here. And that's my feeling.
And we will adapt through this?
Well, I can't say we will adapt, but whether or not we are the same creatures that we are now is not known to me. Not known to anyone as far as I know. Possibly that's the kind of real secret experimentation that's been going on, is that they've been fast-pacing human and animal beings into some kind of a genetic fast track to see what could become of us. They're in a sense so far ahead, and they're kind of sending it back to us into our present. Does that make any sense?
Yes.
Okay.
And one does wonder where they get all of this. Is it just, is this all human only, this amount of knowledge and technology, or is it, is there some artificial intelligence lending it to us, you know?
Well, you know, we change the informing principle in ourselves when we change our chemistry. And I'm very set on this idea that we're 90% microbes, and that microbes are really what constitutes our environment. And so any chemical is a property of a microbe. So the more we are removed from this, the more we are dependent on synthetic kinds of microbes, if you will, synthetic chemistries, then it changes the informing principle of who we are. We become different beings. And if these properties of these other chemicals and microbes that can arise from different kinds of chemistry are something that has been studied, in a very thorough way. They've been tested for their electrical properties, for their transitional properties. Then we can make that extended assumption that they know what they're doing and they know how to control us, and therefore this new kind of intelligence comes into being. I don't see a whole lot of other reason why we would want so many of these chemicals in our products. There's no reason for them to be there. We're not up to knowing. Why are these, 10-syllable chemicals in shampoo, for example? There are things that are in shampoo that are known to permeate the skin and actually penetrate the brain and cause brain lesions there. Why is that there? What's the purpose of having all these chemical additives in these products that we use to buy?
Well, I mean, it's not there by accident.
No, I'm not thinking it's there at all by accident. But why is it there? So we're still left with all these questions of why these chemistries are part of these things that we use on an intimate basis, food additives and things. Why are they there? What are they doing? We know they cause harm. Why can't we stop these chemistries from being added to these most basic things that we all need and use? So it just suggests to me there's a default position here that this is known what is being done here, that they're not using it blindly, that it's actually having a great effect upon changing our whole basis of life.
Well, I will present a little exercise which I read about in The 100-Year Lie as I was reading it. I'm still not finished with that book, but it is a great book. You were asked to write down the number of personal care products you used, and I thought, oh, I hardly use any at all. And so I dismissed it at first, and then later in the day I said, no, wait, how many do I really use? And when you start to list them, you will be amazed at how much, not even just personal care, but anything, cleansers, how many things are in your life with these 10-syllable compounds in them, of course. And each one has 10 of those 10-syllable things in it. So that's a lot of exposure, and that's you having made what you consider to be a wise choice. You know, being brand loyal. Now, this is the best. This is why I use it. And then just do the math. Look at those incredible, unpronounceable words. And then look at the molecules.
Yeah. So we're really getting, think of each one of these chemicals as potentially a radio frequency and carrying information. We're getting an awful lot of information from not earthly sources. Huh.
No, if we go back to the term organic or inorganic, yes,
yeah.
We're getting a lot of crud.
Yeah, a lot of crud that is new chemistry to us, And we sure don't know, you know, how it's being used, but it sure is everywhere, and we're participating in that. And, you know, the easiest thing for me to do is just to keep my focus very simple. And I certainly think about this stuff, and I go to these places, but they're tangents in my research. As I've been sorting my notes, I've been starting to write, so I posted some articles now. I've got some stuff up on the web, and my subjects are polio, of course, which is huge, and I just started posting a series on that. But I've been writing about the Spanish flu, pasteurization, and fallout.
And where can these articles be found?
They're on a website at the moment, www.iamthewitness.com.
Okay, iamthewitness.com.
Right.
And then are they under your name?
They're under my name.
All right.
Right. At the moment, they're on the front page of the website as you go in. So this is Daryl Smith's website, and he's just giving me a lot of leeway here to write about this and develop my story.
Well, we are going off for our last little break. We will be back. You're listening to Expansion on RepublicBroadcasting.org, the RBN network. This is Sophia, your host, and I'm closing this 2 hours with Jennifer Lake, our guest. And I'd like to just mention the author of the book, The 100-Year Lie, that I have spoken of in this interview and another as well, Randall Fitzgerald. It was written in 2006. Published by Dutton, D-U-T-T-O-N, and it's definitely a book everyone should read to gain an understanding of the complexity of what we're all living in.
Yeah, I read The 100-Year Lie. I was disappointed in Randall Fitzgerald, actually, from that book. You know, he feels that he came out at the end of this. He determined that he had all these chemical toxins in his blood and that he was going to go to a detox center, and they put him on a program and he felt much better. And so that's it. If that's the pattern that you want to follow and that's what you want to learn about, that's what he's got to offer. But he doesn't really branch out with this, and he doesn't give us very much else to know believe.
This is a mainstream book.
Yes.
That's the whole point. And
right.
The mainstream, Dutton is not going to publish a book on the stuff that you're talking about.
Right.
But it does give you a sense of what kind of a world you're living in.
Sure. Well, I'd like to point out a doctor who is in Germany today, and his name is Dr. Stefan Lanka. And that's spelled Stefan with an F, and then Lanka is spelled L-A-N-K-A. And I included him in one of the articles that I put up about the Spanish flu. But I'd like to read for you something that he said, and this is what I cobbled together out of a couple of different interviews that he gave. He's been looking at the whole AIDS-HIV thing and all the real shenanigans that has gone on there, a great deal of deception. This was supposed to be the next wave pandemic. Of course, that's kind of petered out in a lot of ways, and it thanks in good part to him and to others like him. But he has this to say. He says, the basis of biological life is togetherness. It's symbiosis. And in this, there is no place for war and destruction. War and destruction in biological life is something purported by sick and criminal brains. In the course of my studies, I and others have not been able to find proof of the existence of disease-causing viruses anywhere. Structures which you can characterize as viruses exist in many species of bacteria and in simple life forms similar to bacteria. They are elements of different cells living together in a common cell type, and this is called symbiosis, an endosymbiosis, arisen in the course of the process of different types of structures combining. He says, this is very important. Viruses are component parts of very simple organisms. So this reframes what we've been told and what we've been taught about virus. And in the coming articles that I'm writing on polio, I hope to reframe this whole scenario about disease and about polio as a prototype disease, as something that was gotten a hold of by Zionist saboteur agents. It was put into the world. It's become hundreds of different kinds of diseases. They held it back until we were in peak fallout, and then radiation itself would be then the disseminator of this kind of disease model, where we have hundreds and hundreds of potential viruses now coming into the world. So there you go.
Well, that's a very damning analysis at the end of our show, but maybe we can have you on another time to flesh it out even more. So thank you so much for coming back, and this will be archived for everyone who missed it today.
Okay, thanks, Sophia.
All right.
Take care. Bye-bye.